From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The world can look a little different if you look at it through the eyes of a mathematician.
In some ways, you could think of God as a mathematician. So much of nature is based on numbers. There are logarithmic spirals that describe seashells. There's something called fractals that describe the branching patterns of blood vessels. All around us, nature is mathematics.
If you find that hard to swallow, wait until you hear about magic squares. Today, the math that unlocks the heart, the universe, and the mind. A glimpse of some of the personalities who solved math's legendary Hilbert problems. And scenes from David Auburn's Broadway hit, Proof.
I had to make sure he bathed my own father.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said
that. After my mother died, it was just me here. And I tried to keep him happy no matter what idiotic project he was doing. He believed that aliens were sending him messages through the Dewey Decimal numbers on the library books. He was trying to work out the code.
What kind of messages?
Beautiful mathematics.
Most mathematicians agree great math should be elegant. If that's the case, it's hard to beat the ancient tradition of Sangaku, or Japanese temple geometry. According to physicist Tony Rothman, the tradition flourished between the 16 and 1700s, Japan's period of isolation from the West.
All manner of people would actually paint geometry problems on wooden tablets and hang them in Buddhist and Shinto shrines all over Japan.
Do you know why they were hung there? Was this for the enjoyment of others? Was this a form of devotion?
I think the probable answer is both. The tradition of hanging tablets in temples goes way back in Japan, far earlier than the 17th century. If you weren't rich enough to donate a horse to the temple, you might paint a picture of a horse on a tablet and hang that in the temple in place. So yeah, these were devotional offerings. On the other hand, I think there's a good chance that a lot of these were hung as challenges to other worshippers. See if you can solve this one.
You've seen many of these tablets in their various places. Can you describe one for me, please?
It's a wooden board with a problem painted on it, usually in very bright colors, blue, red, orange, yellow. Most of them, however, contain multiple problems, some several dozen, and these are very long boards. They can be 12 or 15 feet long by, you know, 3 or 4 feet, and they tend to be hung under the eaves of various temples. They're often elaborately decorated. There's one that's gilded, shines a lot. There's another one that has a carved wooden dragon surrounding it as a frame, so it's extraordinarily beautiful.
But it's so different from what you've come to expect. I mean, in other religions, people have made sacrifices. In Hindu temples, fruit and flowers are offered. Often in churches, you'll find candles lit and that kind of thing. But mathematics, that's unusual.
Well, it's not only unusual, I would say it's unique in world tradition. I don't know of any other country where this takes place. On the other hand, you might say that given the hours that must have gone into solving these things, it is a sacrifice.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the time. You said this flourished in a time when Japan was cut off from the rest of the world.
Well, that's the most remarkable thing about it. If maybe I can tell you a slightly circuitous story that's amusing about how I ran into these. In 1989, one day I dropped in on Freeman Dyson at the Institute for Advanced Study, and he handed me this book that he had just received. And it said Japanese temple geometry problems, and I hadn't the faintest idea of what this was about. I started leafing through this book, and he was watching merrily as my jaw dropped lower and lower. The first thing you notice about these problems is how foreign they look. They don't look anything like the kind of problems you find in American high school geometry text, much more complicated, elaborate, artistic. They look Japanese, you know. The second thing you notice is how beautiful they are. Some of them were clearly first designed as works of art. They look like origami, paper foldings. And somebody probably said, well, let's see what mathematical relationships we can discover in this. And the third thing you notice is just how bloody difficult most of them seem. You know, Freeman was standing there laughing, you know, as I was perusing this book. It was just impossible, some of these problems. And what is amazing is that they did spring up during this period, during the Tokugawa shogunate. in the 17th century when, by imperial decree, Japan had been totally isolated from the West. And I think that explains this very peculiar flavor they have and why they're so different than all other problems. But it's a good argument for an isolationist policy because during this period, which was known as the Genroku period, this was precisely when haiku reached the pinnacle of its development, kabuki, no drama, tea ceremonies, flower arrangings, the floating world pictures, all the traditions that we're, you know, accustomed to thinking about in regard to Japan reached their pinnacle at this point. And it's hard to deny, I think, that this whole tradition, which is known as wasan, the native mathematics, was a result of this policy of isolation.
How does this math compare to Western math of the same period?
Well, it is ordinary geometry. You know, rules of mathematics are universal, and so there's no, what can I say, there's no sort of supernatural elements in this. It's Euclidean geometry. Anybody versed in Euclidean geometry in principle can solve these problems. What's different about Western problems is just sort of the style, the figures themselves, and the techniques that the Japanese of that period used to solve them. They had this thing about high-degree equations. You know, in high school, we're taught to solve quadratic equations, and, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you'll have run into a quartic equation, you know, fourth-degree equation. Some of the equations involved in solving these things are of higher than 1,000 degree, you know.
So are they all difficult? Are all the sangaku beyond ordinary solution?
Not at all. In fact, it's, I think, important to mention one of the loveliest things about this whole tradition is they seem to have been created by all manner of people. Most were probably created by the samurai warriors, who were an educated class of people. But there are also problems signed by merchants and women and children of 13 years of age. And some of them are quite simple. They, you know, any first-year geometry student could solve.
Can you give me an example of the kind of problem that's shown in the tablets?
Well, you know, in an American text, you might have a problem that involves, say, a triangle inscribed in a circle, okay, and you're trying to find out some relationship between the side of the triangle and the diameter of the circle or something like that. You know, in these temple geometry problems, you might have something that resembles that, except instead of one circle, you might have three dozen circles of different sizes all inscribed within the triangle and within each other, and you're supposed to find a relationship between the, you know, 16th largest circle and the side of the triangle or something like that, you know.
What about one of the more difficult problems? What might that involve?
Well, they have some three-dimensional problems, which in fact predated some fairly well-known theorems in the West. For instance, you might imagine a sphere, and inside this outer sphere you inscribe two other spheres of arbitrary size, but just so they're touching each other, if you can imagine that. And then around the waist of those two inner spheres, you inscribe a necklace of more spheres. And the problem asks, well, how many spheres does that necklace contain? And it turns out the answer is six. And this was proven in the 20th century by a famous chemist, Frederick Soddy, who, along with Rutherford, discovered radioactivity. It's known as the Hardy-Sexlett theorem. But this was found on a sangaku tablet dating from the early 19th century. And to do this problem, I've had to enlist some rather sophisticated techniques that are simply not taught in high school or college. It's a bit of a mystery how these Japanese peasants would have gone about doing this. To the best of my knowledge, only one has been found in error.
Tony Rothman teaches physics at Bryn Mawr College. For some of us, math is more torture than recreation or devotion. But there may be a reason for that. Michael Gurian is an educator and author of a book called The Wonder of Girls. He told Anne Strangechamps that the scales are tipped toward boys when it comes to math.
the brain situation is that a lot of girls, the brains are not as well suited or set up to do especially complex math. The male brain tends to develop more cortical areas in the right hemisphere for spatials, which then translate to design, measurement, and so on. And females tend to develop in the right hemisphere, they tend to develop more language centers, so they don't develop as much cortical life or cortical areas for the spatials. So for a lot of girls, they end up better at verbals, not as good at spatials, which then translates to better at reading, writing, and so on, and not as good at math, science.
Has anybody done some sort of study where you put a girl and a boy next to each other, wire them up on PET scans or MRIs or something, and give them some basic math problems, algebra or something to do, and, what's going on in their brains?
Yeah, absolutely. One person who comes to mind is Reuben Gurr at the University of Pennsylvania, who I think is, one of the earliest innovators here, using the MRIs and the PET scans. And he would take, 17, 18, 19-year-olds initially, and he'd put them on the scans, and he'd give them problems. And, okay, so one thing he would notice is that the female brain, when it handles a problem, more brain centers are trying to light up. There's more going on. There's about 15% more blood flow in the brains of the girls than in the brains of the boys, bracketing in all exceptions. There are certainly some exceptions, some boys who have 15% more blood flow, but for the most part, it's the girls. So one thing is there's more blood flow. So they're both doing the same problem. The girls, though, have so much more blood flow and so many more brain centers trying to solve the problem that it gives them an advantage and a disadvantage. It makes them more inductive. They're taking in more to solve the problem. But with just a straight math question, that actually can be a disadvantage. And that male brain that's only using two or three centers and doesn't have as much blood flow can arrive at the answer more quickly because there's less going on. It's more directed, more task-focused. So that's one thing he noticed. He also noticed different parts of the brain lighting up in the girls' brains and in the boys' brains.
Is this all about which centers of the brain tend to be used, or is there also anything about brain chemistry, different levels of different brain chemicals?
Yes, absolutely. The brain centers definitely matter, and also the chemicals and hormones matter. I'll give a for instance. The more testosterone that surged in the mother's womb during gestation, the more brain centers for spatials develop in the right hemisphere of the brain, male or female. Some folks may know that's the time period in the womb when a lot of the gender of the brain is set and is formed. At puberty, we notice also amazing differences. When a girl's estrogen is surging during her cycle, she will tend to do better on her math quiz or her math test. When her progesterone is surging and estrogen and progesterone are out of balance, so this would be the time when she would feel perhaps very moody, very low, almost depressed. During that time in the cycle, her progesterone is very high.
This would be premenstrual.
Especially, better than me, there are the two time periods in the cycle, premenstrual being one of them, when that progesterone is high and that estrogen is low. That's a really bad time to give her a math test. And, we have all these studies that show us that she would do much better if we could give her that test when the estrogen's higher, because what progesterone is doing is sort of shutting down the brain. And what the estrogen does is light up the brain. That's another way in which we've noticed how the brain chemicals affect it. And even a third way, and this is a way that really helps girls, as we change the way we teach math to accommodate the needs of all the children, we notice that the higher serotonin person, which tends to be a female, the female brain secretes more serotonin than the male brain, and serotonin calms us down. And so if we do the external teaching of math in ways that are effective for females, they very quickly can start doing actually better than a lot of the boys who are fidgeting all the time, moving around, and can't focus, because the female brain is already set up to be calmer, to sit in that chair better, to have better fine motor skills in terms of taking notes and writing things down. In some ways, that female brain is better generally set up for learning in our school environments.
Hmm. Is there anything biological you could do, anything parents could do? I mean, we've been talking about brain chemicals. What about supplements or brain exercises or something?
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff out there. I talk a lot about two key things for girls, nutrition and exercise. This is especially true from about 10 on. Why? A lot of it's about hormones and about the hormones, how the hormones cycle, and then it's about brain chemicals. I'm going to give a for instance, nutrition. A lot of kids are eating carbohydrates for breakfast. They're eating cereal. Say at 7:30, they eat their cereal, their Cheerios, let's say, and then they go to school. And so then it's 8:30, they go and they do some math. Well, that was the wrong brain food to do math. It would be the right brain food if they were going to go out and be physical. Certainly, we need the carbs for that. But the carbs are just sort of washing through the brain, doing very little good for problem solving.
What do you need for problem solving?
We want more protein for those kids, and in this case, for those girls early on. We want more protein at 7:30 in the morning. I'm not a doctor who wants to tell people what they should feed their kids, but they'll see the research in my books, and they'll say, oh, okay. I mean, a lot of people write me email and say, oh, you know, I started feeding eggs or some other protein to my girl, and she's doing way better, you know, because they got rid of the carbohydrates.
Why does protein help your brain learn?
Okay, let's give an example. Fish is an example of a protein that you can use which builds these omega-3s. Those omega-3s have a direct relationship to success of the brain in learning. Studies all over the world, Japan, Scandinavia, U.S. So just that omega-3 is helpful. Then protein in itself, it's just better than carbohydrate in a lot of ways because carbohydrates require the body to move this through the body. So the body-brain continuum has to spend a lot of energy moving carbohydrates. It makes the body fidget more. It makes the body want to move more. It can't sit and solve the problem as well. Whereas the protein takes much longer for the body to deal with, and you don't have to stand up and exercise to move the protein through like you would the carbohydrate.
There's one other thing I read. I think I read it in one of your books that was really intriguing, that girls who take iron supplements can do better in math. Is this right?
Right. Iron, oh yeah, there's another big one. Okay. And again, now I'm here on the air. I'm not telling people rush out and get iron supplements. First, talk to someone, especially if your child is on any medication. But having said that, the female body and brain, as every woman knows, especially because of the loss of blood and the hormonal cycle, loses a lot more iron than the male. We have now linked iron to math. We know that girls who take iron supplements, who are not losing as much iron, do better in math. And we notice that iron seems to, you know, I think we'll cement this here in the next year, but already we can see that it seems to help the girls' brains to do problem solving, especially in the area of math. So it's assisting in the spatials. So iron is great. Calcium also, you know, girls lose a lot of calcium, of course, through the hormonal cycle. And when the calcium gets very low, it's hard for the brain to think. So calcium and iron are two to look at.
Michael Gurian's the author of The Wonder of Girls. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him.
Consider the following subtraction problem, which I will put up here. 342 minus 173. Now, remember how we used to do that. 3 from 2 is 9, carry the 1. And if you're under 35 or went to a private school, you say 7 from 3 is 6. But if you're over 35 and went to a public school, you say 8 from 4 is 6. But in the new approach, as you know, the important thing is to understand what you're doing rather than to get the right answer. Here's how they do it now. You can't take 3 from 2, 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make it 3 tens, regroup, and you change a 10 to 10 ones, and you add them to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3, that's 9. Is that clear?
Coming up, the toughest math problems of the 19th century and the crackerjack mathematicians who helped solve them. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Not all brilliant mathematicians get movies made about them, like John Nash and A Beautiful Mind. But maybe they should. Benjamin Yandell is the author of a book called The Honors Class. He says all the solvers of Hilbert problems deserve acclaim for solving some of the toughest math problems around, problems that shape the world of math today. For those of us who aren't in the math loop, what are the Hilbert problems, and just who is Hilbert?
He was really a somewhat universal mathematician. He was German. He worked first in algebra, then algebraic number theory, then in geometry, then in analysis, mathematical physics, then in logic and foundations. He had periods, but he had an incredible breadth and almost a perfect pitch. He had a feel for what was going to pay off. Whatever he treated seemed to get simpler.
Well, I think that in order to understand this, the first thing we need to get some sense of is what the Hilbert problems are. Can you tell me how they came into existence?
David Hilbert was one of the two really dominant great mathematicians in 1900. And mathematicians, like everybody else, when the century changes, when you go from 1800-something to 19, they all get together and they give speeches about what has happened in the past and what's going to happen in the next century. And mathematicians were really getting organized internationally at this time, and they had had one international congress of mathematicians already in 1897, and then they had one planned in 1900 for Paris. And so Hilbert, talking to Hurwitz and Minkowski, basically decided that the best way to talk about where we should go in the future would be to talk about specific mathematical problems, and that he thought would lead people in the right directions, that would, if they worked on this these problems, the solutions would bring great new explosions of mathematics from their success, that they would open up new areas and solve longstanding old problems but lead to new stuff. And it's partly because of who Hilbert was. The problem essay is beautifully put together.
Well, I thought one of the curious things about a number of the mathematicians in your book that I read about was that they seem to come at these problems from an unexpected direction. And one of the reasons was that they were willing to work with other people, to take somebody else's idea, look at it in a different way, and come up with new results.
I think possibly the public has an image of mathematicians as isolate and socially awkward. I don't know. People have done polls where they asked British school students, and British school students said something like, oh, mathematicians are frumpy, unpopular, and have sweaty palms or something. And that, in turns out, is really not true. And they are actually quite social. I mean, they're such a range that anything you can think of, you can find a mathematician to fit that example. But they do talk to each other. One of the problems in researching this book is when I was trying to get in touch with present-day mathematicians, they were always flying off to go to talk to somebody, you know, in France or in Germany or in Sweden. There was a great deal of movement, a great deal of discussion. Even someone like John Nash, he started from not knowing anything about a problem and tried to build up from scratch, sort of work it out for himself. But he did it talking to the most expert person he could find. And he'd go back and say, well, what about this and what about this? And the person would say, boy, this guy's clueless. And then somehow he kept at it and came back and said, oh, my gosh, he's done something really, really famous. And that's kind of a pattern.
I think we can establish that maybe by talking about some of the people that you've written about. I mean, Siegel, for instance. Yeah. Is anything but a dull, boring eccentric. He was—he seems to have been very social, but extraordinarily bright,
and difficult, and passionate, and he had strong opinions. But I think at base, he was passionate about mathematics and what he wanted to do, and he did it almost like an art. And his writing about it, and everything about it—it was anybody who loved mathematics was willing to forgive him.
A complex man, but in the end, a good one, a friend you'd want to have. Mm. Which of the Hilbert problems did he solve?
He didn't solve flat out any one problem, but his results are directly leading up to a number of them. The seventh problem about transcendental numbers, he had a couple of results that set the stage for the final solution, which was made by a Russian, Eyal Gelfand, and his student, Theodor Schneider. Mm. And so he didn't close off the deal, but he created a lot of the machinery. He made a couple of different contributions to the 10th problem, one in 1929, one in 1972. So he had a long, active life.
Didn't he actually throw somebody's thesis overboard at one point?
Yeah. He had a good friend, Bessel Hagen, who was not as good a mathematician as Siegel and in a different area. And Bessel Hagen gave him his thesis, which back in the old days where there weren't copy machines, was the only copy, and said, read it and comment on it. Tell me if it holds up. And Siegel was burdened by research and burdened by this, and he was out in the middle going to Norway or something out in the North Sea, and it became too much for him. and he threw it overboard and drowned the thesis and then marked the coordinates where he had buried it. And then apparently he told Bessel-Hagen when he came back that he had done him a favor. But obviously this is not a favor.
But they made up after that?
Yeah, they made up and went to Greece and had a great time. And you go through the people who knew Siegel, and all of them seem to have this kind of story about him, but they all forgave him because of the good things about him.
Yeah. Well, and some of the other stories that you relate, while on the edge of hard or even cruel, are also funny, and you can see where they would see the humor. There was a box of live crabs at one of his
dinners. Oh, yes. He invited Hel Braun over for dinner and said, now we will cook dinner or something like that. And he knew that earlier he had tried to get her to make him some coffee. She had refused and said, oh, so you can't make coffee. So one of the next visits, they started cooking, and he had a box, and he opened it up, and all kinds of crabs crawled out, horrifying Hel Braun, and all over the kitchen, and they had quite a set, too, and they had the perfect champagne to go with it. They ended up having a very good meal, but it was quite a emotional roller coaster for Braun.
One more story before you go. Another Hilbert solver is Andrei Komolgorov.
He was one of the solvers of the 13th problem, but he also, the sixth problem, which was to axiomatize physics, again, one of the problems that hasn't been finished, but that is still of interest. Hilbert specifically talked about axiomatizing probability theory because you needed a rigorous understanding of how probabilities work to do various physical things like how gases work. And Kolmogorov totally solved that piece of that problem as well.
Now, this is a guy who is also, like some of the others you've talked about, from a varied background and of varied interests himself. I mean, he was named, wasn't he, for one of the characters in Tolstoy's...
He was named after Prince Andrei Bolkonsky in War and Peace by his mother, who was a rebel, and his father, and they had not bothered to get married, and they were sort of heading down into the south of Russia and gave birth to Andrei in this town, and the mother died, and the father couldn't take care of him, and he went back, an illegitimate son to this noble family. Again, this was before he was born in 1903, so this is before the revolution, but things were starting to heat up. And the family took responsibility for him, is how they put it. But he was raised by one of his mother's sister, and Aunt Vera, who was just a wonderful lady. But when he came to her, she was very radical. She was part of the ferment like her sister. And so there was an illegal printing press in the house, and sometimes the illegal materials were hidden under Andre in his crib. So he came out of this ferment. Yeah. And then when he was, say, 14, the revolution happened, and then everything changed. And
you know, this doesn't sound like, though, the way a great mathematician is engendered, does it?
The more you read about mathematicians, the more you realize this is as good a way as any. They really come from everywhere. At some point, they've got native ability that's almost, you know, just in their brain. And at some point, something in their background, some combination of things makes them passionately interested in it, and then they take off.
Benjamin Yandell is the author of The Honors Class, Hilbert's Problems and Their Solvers.
Number nine.
Make no mistake about it, there is a bit of mystery and magic in numbers. Just listen to the Beatles. Or Clifford Pickover, a scientist who does research in the fields of physics and math and art. Recently, Pickover turned his fancy to magic squares. Now, if you're a magic square neophyte, like me, here's an example. Take a 3x3 square with the magic sum of 15. It's one square divided into three rows and three columns with a number in each box. Now, here's the magic part. The top row across says 4, 9, and 2. That equals 15. The second row across reads 3, 5, and 7. 15. Now the third row, 8, 1, and 6. 15 again. Try the diagonals. They equal 15, too. The bigger the square, the harder it is, and more symmetries and patterns you can create. Pickover told Steve Paulson there's a long, rich history behind magic squares.
The first magic square probably appeared around 2000 BC in China, and the legend has it where Emperor Yu was walking along the Yellow River and found a turtle with spots on its back. And just like magic squares, they had the same sum in all the directions. And supposedly the turtle spent years in the king's court and had the company of mathematicians and all sorts of visiting dignitaries.
So this became the most famous turtle in the world, the one with these magic numbers on its back.
That's right. And from there, it gradually grew in importance all over the world. In about 1000 AD, magic squares appeared in India. Even Ben Franklin in the 1700s, he said, oh, it's a waste of time to study these things. But then he spent hours and hours and developed amazing magic squares, larger magic squares.
In fact, didn't Ben Franklin come up with an amazing magic square of his own discovery?
Yes, Ben Franklin came up with many different types of squares. And what makes them amazing is that they go beyond simple magic squares that have the same sums of the numbers in the different directions, but they have additional patterns and symmetries. And interestingly, these magic squares, because of these symmetries, it's a little hard to explain without seeing the pictures, but they've been used all over the world and studied. People in Nigeria have been fascinated by them, the Mayan Indians, the ancient Babylonians. In India, people would use different number squares for finding a husband. A woman would write the numbers on a china plate and then wash them off and actually drink it. And all sorts of mystical associations. Turks would put these on their soldiers' shirts to protect them against danger. And so I go into the history, and then I start looking at all the unusual individuals today who study them.
Well, I can see the appeal for people with a religious bent, why they would gravitate to magic squares, because the suggestion is there is some kind of underlying divine order in the universe, because people aren't just making up these numbers. The numbers are out there, but it's a matter of figuring out the patterns that are somehow already there.
Yeah, in a way, I think of mathematics akin to an archaeologist making discoveries. You know, some people think we invent mathematics, like William Shakespeare invents a story. I think, in a sense, when mathematicians are making theorems and creating magic squares, they're almost making discoveries in the same way you might discover a mountain peak. You brought up mathematics and mysticism. Certainly, this mystical association with numbers and religion has gone on for centuries. In some ways, you could think of God as a mathematician. So much of nature is based on numbers. There's something called the Fibonacci numbers that tells us about the arrangement of seeds in the sunflower. There are logarithmic spirals that describe seashells. There's something called fractals that describe the branching patterns of blood vessels. All around us, nature is mathematics.
So do some of these spiritualists from the past who were drawn to magic squares, did they make that connection explicitly, sort of this connection between God and math?
Well, the ancients certainly made it in alchemy. They thought they could use magic squares to transform metals. They used it in art. Albrecht Dürer had a picture of an angelic figure with magic squares in the background. So there were all these mystical associations. And in some way, mathematics has, I think, an intersection with religion. Mathematics ponders the infinite often, just like religion. They're often non-material truths that the mathematicians work with, just like religious people, and they try to apply it to the real world. And both math and religion often has a very mystical or arcane symbol, so I see some similarities there.
You mentioned the great Renaissance artist Albrecht Dürer, who had his own magic square. In fact, it's been called the Dürer Square. And I have to say, it's fascinating. You have a picture of it in your book, and there are four boxes in each direction. Each one adds up to 34, but it goes beyond that.
Yes, the square that I show is just an array, a 4x4 array of numbers. But if you notice, there's a 15, 14. One cell has 15, another 14 in the array, and that's the year that Dürer made the etching. And the engraving that it's part of, it's called Melancholia, is very mysterious. I don't even think artists or scholars understand all the symbols in it. There's all these scattered tools and flowing sands in a glass. But right in the background, underneath the bell, there's a magic square that he invented. And in the book, I go into all the marvelous symmetries. And you could really spend minutes, hours, days trying to really grasp all the hidden symmetries in these magic squares.
So if you add up the numbers in each line, for instance, the bottom line is going to add up to 34, the top line will be 34, the diagonal will be 34, and then the middle four squares, if you add those up, they also come to 34.
Right. Like many magic squares in the book, we can go beyond the ordinary definition of magic square and find all sorts of patterns. And in Dervish Square, you mentioned a few extras, but there's many, many different ways of getting the magic sum of 34 by summing different numbers in the array. And they almost make crystalline patterns when you're trying to connect the lines or connect the numbers that are forming these magic sums.
Why do you think some people get so obsessed with this? I mean, there's no obvious payoff or practical payoff. I mean, these are mind games, but obviously fascinating.
I think one reason is it's so simple to explain once you can see it on paper that even beginners can play around with them. And then from there, certain people latch onto them. I have magic squares from people in jail, for example. They've created magnificent things. I always wonder, you know, if you could reward prisoners for these magnificent magic squares, what effect that might have on society or research. I talk about some people, one in particular called the Great Fubini, who was suicidal. And he got out of his depression, suicide, by creating ever larger magic squares. And that became an obsession for him. But he said that magic squares saved my life.
I've read about some people who've actually tried to find connections between magic squares and quantum physics.
There are all sorts of possible connections. There's something called Latin squares, which are useful in statistics and trying to organize different experiments and layouts. So there are hints at possible applications. But I would say for the most part, it's more what you call recreational math. And I don't think that demeans in any way, because mathematics is pure mind stuff, and you never know. I mean, the whole universe seems to be built up on mathematics, from string theory to quantum physics, so mathematics seems to underpin it all. I think magic squares is one fun way for even amateurs to start getting involved in the excitement. And amateurs do certainly make new discoveries in magic squares.
Science researcher Clifford Pickover is the author of The Zen of Magic Squares. He talked with Steve Paulson. If you'd like to take a look at more magic squares, stop by our website, wpr.org/book. Just ahead, The Genius and Madness in the Quest for Proof. Inside David Auburn's award-winning Broadway play, when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. David Auburn won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his play called Proof. It's a story of a young woman named Catherine, grieving over the loss of her father, a famous mathematician who suffered from dementia. After Catherine's father dies, an old student of his named Harold Dobbs comes by to see if there is any worthwhile math in her father's old notebooks. Erica Kreutz plays Catherine. Robert Quinlan plays Harold in the Madison Repertory Theater production of Proof. Kreutz told Anne Strandchamps about the genius of Catherine's father.
I always think of it as his left brain was on fire, and his mathematical genius was spinning and spinning, and then a glitch happened, and it went into sort of the gray line between madness and genius, and that something in there caught on fire, and so he started seeing math in everything, seeing math on the newspaper, in a cup of coffee, in sports pages, in the Dewey Decimal numbers on the library books. He thinks that aliens were sending him messages through that. It's just a constant seeing patterns in things where it's not really socially acceptable to find patterns in these things. It's a little odd.
And Robert, you play Hal. Who's Hal?
Harold Dobbs is the prize graduate student of Catherine's father. And he comes over, not to give too much away about the play, but we'll be reading scenes anyway. So the father is dead at the beginning of the play. And he comes over to go through and read the notebooks that the father left behind and try to find any traces of brilliant mathematics in those notebooks.
Is there a scene you could do from the beginning of the play that would give us a sense of, you know, kind of how they're talking about the father and what he meant to them?
Sure.
When your father was younger than both of us, he made major contributions to three fields: game theory, algebraic geometry, and nonlinear operator theory. Most of us never get our head around one. He basically invented the mathematical techniques for studying rational behavior, which economists have been milking for Nobels ever since. And he gave the astrophysicists plenty to work over, too, okay?
Don't lecture me.
I'm not. I'm telling you, if I came up with 1/10 of the shit your dad produced, I could write my own ticket to any math department in the country.
Give me your backpack.
What?
Give me your backpack.
Why?
I want to see what's inside it.
What?
Open it and give it to me.
Oh, come on.
You're not taking anything out of this house.
You're hoping
to find something upstairs that you can publish.
Sure.
Then you can write your own ticket.
What? Oh, no, it would be under your dad's name. It would be for your dad.
I don't believe you. You have a notebook in that backpack.
What are you talking about?
Give it to me.
You're being a little paranoid.
Paranoid?
Maybe
a little. I know you have one of my notebooks.
I think you should calm down and think about what you're saying.
I'm saying that you're lying to me and you're stealing my family's property.
And I think that sounds paranoid.
Just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean there isn't something in that backpack.
You just said yourself there's nothing up there. Didn't you?
Yes.
Didn't you say that? So what would I take? Right?
You're right.
Thank you.
So you don't need to come back.
Please. Someone should know for sure whether or not your father was able to...
I lived with him. I spent my life with him. I fed him. I talked to him. I tried to listen when he talked. Talked to people who weren't there. Watched him shuffling around like a ghost. A very smelly ghost. He was filthy. I had to make sure he bathed my own father.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said
that. After my mother died, it was just me here. And I tried to keep him happy no matter what idiotic project he was doing. He used to read all day. He kept demanding more and more books. I took them out of the library by the carload. We had hundreds upstairs. Then I realized that he wasn't reading. He believed that aliens were sending him messages through the Dewey Decimal numbers on the library books. He was trying to work out the code.
What kind of messages?
Beautiful mathematics. Answers to everything. The most elegant proofs, perfect proofs, proofs like music.
Sounds good.
Plus fashion tips, knock-knock jokes. I mean, it was nuts, okay?
He was ill. It was a tragedy.
Later, the writing face, scribbling 19, 20 hours a day. I ordered him a case of notebooks and he used every one. I dropped out of school. I'm glad he's dead.
It's a really powerful play.
Yeah, it is.
It's good writing.
It's really good writing. And what I think is interesting is when you dissect it, it's almost like a mathematical proof.
In what way?
There's no wasted moves. That it's almost like a poem that all the extra words have been taken out. If you add these two people, Catherine and Hal, together in a scene, both wanting something totally different, what is going to happen? What's the equation at the end? And it almost leaves you with, okay, zero. Both of them are at zero. Or it ends on a positive or a negative. It almost unfolds like a mystery, but even more so, it's a problem. We got four people on stage with a problem, and you mix those chemicals together and see what happens and what comes out of it.
And these are not the ordinary people you'd necessarily
meet
at the supermarket and on the street. I mean, Hal, for instance, he's, you know, calls himself a geek mathematician.
Tell about
his band.
But he also plays in sort of a punk rock band that does songs about math.
And what is the name? Don't know the name of the band, but one of the featured numbers
is called Imaginary Number. written out lowercase I, which is actually an imaginary number, so they just stand there and don't play any of their instruments for 3 minutes and stand there in silence.
That's a math joke.
And it's a math joke. So
there's a lot in the play, a lot of references to the elegance and beauty of math. Mm-hmm. Did you get that feeling? Did you learn that from the play at all?
I don't have a background in math, even though my dad is a math teacher. But what I did to play the role is these people are passionate about math. So I tried to substitute things that I was really passionate about. Like I'd think about a beautiful Shakespeare sonnet or a beautifully constructed play, like a Streetcar Named Desire, something that I really relate to as something beautiful, and substitute that in whenever they're talking about with so much passion about these mathematical proofs.
One of the things that tensions that drives the play is the feeling that for Catherine, it's unusual enough that she's a math genius, but she's also a woman.
Yeah.
And she's almost not believed and not, credited because she's a female. And that's a big part in the play, too, right?
Right. And she's also unstudied. She started at school at Northwestern and didn't finish because her father had a relapse. And so she became a caretaker. So there's not really anything credited to her name. She doesn't have anything to stand on except for that she's inherited this, and living in the house for 25 years, she talks to her dad through math. They almost have conversations on a different level and share that insight.
There's a really beautiful scene. I wonder if you would do it when she's beginning to express to Hal something of what it means to her vulnerability as a woman who can do math. And she's talking about one of her heroines, Sophie Germain. Could you do a bit from
that
scene?
Sure, absolutely.
I went to this conference in Toronto last fall. I'm young, right? I'm in shape. I thought I could hang with the big boys. Wrong. I've never been so exhausted in my life. 48 straight hours of partying, drinking, drugs, papers, lectures.
Drugs?
Oh, yeah. Amphetamines, mostly. I mean, I don't, but some of the older guys are really hooked.
Really?
Yeah, they think they need it.
Why?
They think that math is a young man's game. Speed keeps them racing, makes them feel sharp. There's this fear that creativity peaks around 23, and it's all downhill after that. Once you hit 50, it's over. Might as well teach high school.
That's what my dad thought.
I don't know. Some people stay prolific.
Not many.
No, you're right. Really original work, it's all young guys.
Young guys.
Young people.
But it's men mostly, right?
There are some women.
Who?
There's a woman at Stanford. Can't remember her name.
Sophie Germain.
Yeah, I think I've probably seen her at meetings. I just don't think I've met her.
She was born in Paris in 1776.
So I've definitely never met her.
She was trapped inside of her house. The French Revolution was going on, the terror. She had to stay inside for safety, so she spent time reading in her father's study, the Greeks. Later, she tried to get a real education, but the schools wouldn't allow women. So she wrote letters. She wrote to Gauss. She used a man's name, Antoine Auguste Leblanc. She sent him some proofs involving a certain kind of prime number, important work. He was delighted to correspond with such a brilliant young man. Dad, give me a book about her.
I'm stupid. Sophie Germain, of course.
You know her.
Germain primes.
Right.
They're famous. Double them and add one, you get another prime. Like two. Two is prime. Double plus one is five. Also prime.
Right. Or 92,305 times 2 to the power of 16,998 plus 1.
Right.
That's the biggest one. The biggest one known.
Huh. Did he ever find out who she was? Gauss?
Yeah. Later, a mutual friend told him that the brilliant young man was a woman. He wrote to her, a taste for the mysteries of numbers is excessively rare. But when a person of the sex, which according to our customs and prejudices, must encounter infinitely more difficulties than men to familiarize herself with these thorny researches, succeeds nevertheless in penetrating the most obscure parts of them, then, without a doubt, she must have the noblest courage, quite extraordinary talent, and superior genius. I memorized it.
That scene makes you smile, but it makes you cry inside, too.
Yeah. It's a lonely world that she finds herself in.
Oh, yeah.
And if she doesn't do math, if she doesn't do this after midnight when Dad has gone to sleep, it's almost like taking the paintbrushes away from Van Gogh. It's taking a pencil away from Mozart. There's a sense of this deep need to put this down on paper and to get it all out. But her fear is that it's not correct. It's not worth anything. And that's why she keeps it locked up. She has a very lonely life. And that's why when Hal comes in and starts talking to her about the beauty of math, she gets a first glimpse of, this is someone maybe I could trust. Maybe I could show him a little bit of my light. And ultimately, it's not a play about math. And it's not even about genius. And I think David Auburn, the playwright, made that statement that something, the human heart is bigger than any mathematical theorem.
Erica Kreutz plays Catherine in the Madison Repertory Theater production of David Auburn's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Proof. Robert Quinlan plays Harold Dobbs, and Strainchamp spoke with them. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mary Lou Finnegan, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Proof by Numbers, number 922B.
PRI, Public Radio International.